quiet enough.
Sure. Can you say where we are? Can you say where we are?
We are in the teacher's lunchroom at Manzanita Seed Elementary School.
And you want to see, do you want to introduce yourself?
My name is Don McClay. I'm one of the parent volunteers here, and I'm also a candidate for District 1 City Council.
Beautiful. And you're a member of the...
Of the Green Party, yes. A very public member of the Green Party.
Excellent.
Here, let me just show you.
I'll show you.
So, basically, we have parent volunteers do different things. Some help in the classrooms. Some of us help distribute food for the... For the students, we're really trying to push, you know, better nutrition and stuff like that. Some help here with activities for kids that want or need them, right? And then my job, much less interesting, we process the computer donations and things like that. I'm a computer geek by trade. So we have been getting various donations from different sources.
Cool.
And we're trying to supplement what the district provides to the school. And this all just came from a nonprofit in the city that closed down, gave us a whole bunch of their stuff, and just solved our computer equipment shortage for the beginning of this trimester.
Oh, that's amazing. Have you been a parent volunteer here for a while?
I've been a parent volunteer since my other son was in the second grade. And he is now 22. He's graduating from Davis.
So for a little bit, it's for some time.
I've been at it for a while, yeah. So welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for agreeing to talk to me.
My pleasure.
Spoke with Amy Lemley this morning.
Oh, wow. You're going to find that Amy and I have a lot in common. And one big decision, we didn't make the same.
What? Tell me about the difference. Or say what's in common first.
Well, of the traditional candidates, Amy has really impressed me with her understanding of intergovernmental affairs. And intergovernmental affairs are very ignored, yet they really make up a lot of the reality of what you're going to get. Mm. There is a line between what the city provides and what the county provides, what the state provides, and who has which authority where. So, you know, a lot of times we sit there and we say, oh, well, we would like to have a restorative justice program, yada, yada. Well, the city doesn't prosecute. The county prosecutes, yeah. Right? So, yeah, I'm all for it. But it means that we have to have an agreement with the county to do it. Amy's very sharp on that.
Can you ask if we can rearrange a little bit? I just don't want to point the mic right there. So
wherever you want.
If you want to sit on the couch, if that's comfortable for you.
I'm fine.
Cool, thank you. So
I'm
what's
kind of catching my breath a little.
Oh, yeah, why? What's?
Oh, I'm an asthmatic.
Okay, yeah. Do you want to pause it all? Or?
Fine.
So
I'll have asthma for the rest of my life. So.
Yeah.
If I sound a little out of breath, that's me.
Okay.
It works well in the public meetings because I always need to stand up. So now everybody else stands up too.
Interesting.
But I stand up out of need.
Like city council meetings or?
Anywhere. Forums, anytime, yeah. I have to speak, I need to stand up because I don't have the breath. I'm an asthmatic.
Okay. Would you prefer to stand up while we talk?
No.
Okay.
I'm fine.
So I'm interested in your the difference.
Oh, the difference between, well, it's not just Amy. Ms. Lemley, Mr. Kalb, Mr. Link, and Mr. Rea have all chosen to build their campaigns out of the normal building blocks. The incumbent has left, so they have permission to run. And so they don't step on anybody's toes, and they know influential people, and then you build a campaign that's made out of fundraising and endorsements, more influential people, more fundraising. And I understand that's the way the system works, right? But that's also part of what I don't agree with. And I'm refusing to build my campaign out of the building blocks of money and influential people and stuff like that. Not like I'm refusing endorsements. I have an endorsement from the teachers union. But on the other hand, I'm really steering clear of anything that would be a conflict of interest. The campaign is really more of a movement. We don't have a campaign manager. We don't have a PR firm, anything like that. We're the Green Party. We have an outreach committee. We're a movement. We'll be here long after this campaign is over. And I consider politics, grassroots politics, as movement building, not as just some PR production to do vote marketing. get myself in. There's more important things than just winning. Although we're trying to win. Very much trying to win.
So this would be a movement built around what?
Well, my top priority is pretty much shared with every green candidate in Oakland right now. And that's the facing the crisis that's facing Oakland youth. And we just, I don't mean to sound rote, but we see the crisis as employment, education, crime, being caught up in crime, and housing. And that is the toughest nut to crack. That's where the issues are. And there's a lot of other things you could do. You could have a little cute little bus that runs around downtown. You could attend climate action meetings. But what the city of Oakland needs more than anything else is for us to focus on the issues that are hurting our young people. And by way of cleaning the worst problem, the side benefits are it will address the major issues of crime and education and development that hurts the whole city.
So how does the city do that? What kinds of policies would start to address the problem?
Well, first is you stop digging a deeper hole. So what I'd really like to see the city do is three things fast. We should stop putting people into the criminal justice system. And we should have a triage down at the Oakland Police Department before we refer somebody to the county. Every last case should be reviewed and see if there is some restorative way that we could deal with this case, defer prosecution, and actually get the person in the community making restitution in a positive manner. For every one of those that we succeed at, we have prevented a large amount of crime. On the flip side, everybody who gets out on parole and we make a place for in the community, a place to live, a job to work at, right? Wraparound services, whatever they might need. Every one of those people we can bring into the community and not just bring back into the crime side of our community is also, you know, these are the gifts that keep on giving. And then every neighborhood we can organize to get the neighbors feeling involved and in possession of our community policing, of our neighborhood crime prevention councils, every last one of those, we can put the crime down. We can actually step up enforcement. And, you know, there's other things we need to be doing. We need to be getting more civilian employees in the police and stuff like that. And then the other side, the other big piece of it is employment and education. I don't believe in the city interfering in the school district. Doesn't mean we can't help. We have a lot of things we already do in our libraries. We have teen centers. We have homework clubs. We have things like that. Those mean a lot. A little bit of transportation to and from schools to teen centers and from teen centers back to homes, bridging the gap for working families who can't be directly connected to their teens, paying attention to making sure that our parks, our museums, those kinds of things are available to our schools. Those are the kinds of things that a city can do on that end. It can make a big difference. And for employment, I mean, Oakland does actually have a very wide base of employment. We don't have enough of it, but it's very diverse. Most of it's small business, followed quickly by a large section of people who work for various levels of government. And then we have, you know, everything that people pay more attention to, the Cloroxes and the medical and all that kind of stuff. And I really think we should cultivate a better space for it, grow the businesses we currently have, and really work with them. Say, you know, hey, you have to hire these parolees. You have to give a place for Oakland youth. We only need the crime to go down some and the values of our schools to go up some and the public safety index to be going up a bit. And we start getting into a different loop where our property values start to go up. Our community becomes a better investment. We need to just kind of change the trend. I don't really believe in magic wand, big projects, stuff like that. I think we need a lot more housekeeping. Just stick to the basics. Work on that for 4 years.
So going back to what you said, the primary issue was of diverting youth out of the criminal justice system towards a restorative model. I've heard Alameda County's doing pretty good on that. Nancy O'Malley's behind it somewhat, or is there still a lot of work? And what can the city really do? Because like you said, it is a county issue, kind of.
Or you said, so it starts in at the police stations. Can you say more?
Well, yeah. I mean, the current paradigm is the city arrests. We refer to the DA's office for prosecution. The judges and all the superior court system decides. And then a mix of county and state incarcerates and supposedly reforms. And you can just kind of say sorry for the reform part. And then at the next end of the other end of the program is the city then has to reintegrate. Once the CDC or whoever the CDCR now, it's called the prisons, kick somebody loose, we are the local community that takes them back in. So what can the city do? I think we could just do more. I think the building blocks are there. I think what the Alameda County has already started, I like it. I think it's a little too volunteerist. I would like it to be much more formal, much more explicit, and run right out of our police department. I think that we should be thinking of this as our policy and how we do things, not just something that one judge gets to decide to do or one employee at the DA's office wants to do. And I think that Ms. O'Malley has done some things, but does anybody get promoted at the DA's office for getting people successfully into diversion programs? Or do they get promoted because they got the convictions and the numbers of years? And there's a mix. It's not as bad as it might look, but it is not a formal agreement. We do not have a formal agreement between the city of Oakland and the county of Alameda, or between the city of Oakland and the DA's office. And we are not thinking of those things that we know work. Keeping people, if they have to be incarcerated, keeping them incarcerated where they can have contact with their families, where they can start to develop the relationships they'll need for when they get out, get into community. And that needs to become policy.
So do you think the OPOA and would accept that?
Oh, yeah. This has nothing to do with the OPOA. If nothing else, this is the kind of thing that would make their lives easier. I'm a big fan of McRae, who is one of the founders of restorative justice out of New Zealand. He is a police officer. He got into it. He didn't believe in the system. And the reason he was put in there was because his city in New Zealand felt they were just spending too much money on people that were probably didn't need to have the hammer come down on them, so that they could free up their police to drop the hammer on people who did need to have the hammer come down on them. That's the kind of thinking I think we can come together on. I think the Police Officers Association has every interest in seeing the morale of the police come up. And there's nothing that makes a police force morale come up than to be successful and have a good relationship with the community.
I'm interested in your membership in the Green Party, what the role of the Green Party is in a city like Oakland that's very progressive, and why you're a member of the Green Party.
There's a couple of good reasons. One is just the values. I share the values of the Green Party. Several of our 10 key values interface directly with city politics. We believe in grassroots democracy. We believe in local control, right? And there's also another thing is I personally believe in keeping myself independent and building an alternative. And I was talking before about how these other candidates basically find themselves depending on the fundraising and the endorsements and the whole set of favors. And I think that's part of why things don't get done. And if you look where Greens have been elected in local politics, we've had the freedom of action. We are not part of some Democratic Party club. We are not part of some faction that's trying to get some development project going somewhere. We get to actually serve in office. And you look at what's happening in Richmond, what's been happening in San Francisco, what happens off and on here. And some of our local politicians started as Greens. And I decided to stay with the Green Party to keep that independence and also just to keep pushing these values.
Is Oakland a city that's friendly to Green Party ideals, or is it kind of hard to be a member here?
No, I find it very friendly to Green Party ideals. Rebecca Kaplan ran originally as a Green. She made the decision that she would rather win than then stay a Green, and she thinks that that's the only way to win. We've proved her wrong in Richmond, and we hope to prove her wrong again here in Oakland. But, you know, with Amy Allison, Rebecca Kaplan, Larry Shoup, we've had several very successful campaigns. Wilson Riles, who was a Democrat when he ran for mayor, is a Green now. So we have, you know, we have some meat to our organization. And the public's perception is very positive. Some of the public still thinks that Rebecca Kaplan is a Green. We hear that all the time. And we also get a lot of people feeling that, you know, that the Green Party offers a almost a neutral party in all the factional fighting that's taking place. And there is a lot of factional fighting. And in a way, they're right. We do kind of work with all the various groups in town, whether it's block by block or the Tramatola group or Great Oakland Public Schools, you know, the various factions of Democrats that can infight pretty roughly. But to us, that's not a relevant thing. What's relevant is, you know, what are we going to vote for? What are our policies going to be?
What's the stance toward development as a Green Party candidate and as a District 1 candidate? Are you in favor of Oakland kind of getting dense, high, expensive buildings built?
I don't have a one-size-fits-all answer to that. And development is a word that's thrown around for a lot of things. The Green Party is a very pro-government party. We believe in an activist government. So, yes, we are a tax and spend liberals, if you wish. We are not spend and borrow liberals. And we don't like a government that is precariously in debt, right? We want a government that's stable, reliable. And we're not really particularly interested in welfare for the rich. So when you say a development project, I'm kind of old-fashioned. I want to see the contract. I want to see who pays for what. What do we get out of it? What is actually a guaranteed outcome and what is projected outcome based on certain market things happening? And I think if you look at things like the Uptown Project and whatnot with that point of view, you would not be so happy with the results for what it cost. As to what type of form and structure the neighborhood should have, I really think the neighborhood should have more input into that. I'm kind of concerned about the informality of the process with the neighbors, with consulting with neighborhoods. We don't really have elected neighborhood committees, stuff like that. Personally, I'm not a big fan of infill development. I am not a big fan of, you know, large buildings and stuff like that. But then we also, you know, need at some point to give an alternative to urban sprawl. I also think a lot of attention needs to be placed on converting our buildings, our existing structures, and making them more green. And there's a lot you can do there. And making them more neighborhood friendly so that, you know, people can live, shop, work in their neighborhoods. I really believe in walkable neighborhoods. But all this, it's like I said, it's a dialogue. And the dialogue really has to start with the neighborhoods and the community as a whole.
I'm curious why you're opposed to infill development.
Well, it's another thing that's been used to say different things. Which type of infill development, right? Building up areas that are underutilized, you know, putting in a two-story building where there was a two-story building, but making better use of the space, stuff like that, sure, right? But is what they want to do in Upper Broadway Valdez infill development? It really is like they're planning on building Hong Kong between the freeway and the YMCA building. And I think most of the public doesn't know anything about it. And some of these other projects, they don't even come close to filling the actual goals of infill development. The Oak to Ninth project, you know, it's basically an apartment building complex, right? And it doesn't really, it doesn't meet the environmental standards, it doesn't meet some other standards, and it really seems to have a lot to do with the politicians who supported the developers that were behind it.
So you feel like those spaces just aren't the best use of that land or don't serve the needs of the neighborhood?
Well, each one is a little bit different. What I really criticize the council for and what I'll work on if elected is the lack of a general plan. What we have is a general laundry list, not really a plan. It is hundreds and hundreds of pages of over elaborate map making, but we don't really have a concept upon which we're going to build this city, we're going to upgrade this city, and in what direction are we going to deal with the obvious coming population increase, right? Oakland will increase in population in the next 25 years. How do we see that happening? What lifestyle do they think we're going to have there? How is that going to relate with our transit and stuff like that? You know, and putting a few shops and a couple of apartment buildings in a metro station, you know, in a BART station is not a transit plan, right? It maybe is a transit village. I just find the current stuff very short-sighted.
So it's, speaking of economic development, different candidates have different ideas, courting business, streamlining, zoning, planning. I'm wondering what you offer.
Well, I was talking to you before. I'm very much into the idea of starting with making sure we're taking care of the business we have. I think we have a very dynamic economy. I think this economy could hire more. It's very well known that the small business sector, when it does hire, it doesn't let go as quickly as big boxes and stuff like that. And, you know, we have to look at the whole thing. What is our business environment? Under what conditions are we able to provide benefits to our employees in the small business sector? Under what conditions are people able to be government employees? Let's look at the employees they are. What kind of education and background are we providing people so they could work in Auto Row or work in, you know, housing maintenance or the major things that are happening, right? Work in the medical business, right? Work in government. So, you know, I think if we think about our general support for the business we have and work together with our community colleges, our own school district, the sectors that exist, I think we create a better economic environment. The other thing that's happening is a lot of small-scale unusual developments are taking place. We're starting to grow food in Oakland. We're starting to do a lot of what might have been considered artisan-type work. Businesses and small collectives and things like that are popping up all over. And I think maybe we should take a look that this might be one of the growth areas of the 21st century. Anytime we have people able to create economic activity, we should be listeners and followers as much as leaders at certain times.
Do you see redevelopment as a big blow to the city's ability to attract investment?
No. I see it as a big blow to the house of cards that was our budget. And, you know, moving $1 billion out of the county to the city to manage under this, you know, dual hat system where the city council with no counterpart just took off their city council hat, put on their development committee hat, and made decisions over $1 billion worth of spending a year without a mayor or anybody else. It was $1 billion a year. Between that and the loan, yeah, redevelopment was almost as large as the general fund. And then they were spending redevelopment dollars on general fund activities.
I'd love to learn more about it because I've... Where did you hear that?
Oh, no, if you look at the entire package, I'm talking about not just the money they were spending directly in the city's general fund, but what were those loans or what were those authorizations? That was a lot of money. And it was almost like a shell game. It was sort of like, okay, well, we're going to help finance some project over here. And, you know, the mayor didn't have a veto. There's no oversight. The auditor, it didn't fall under the auditor. You know, that kind of government we can do without, right? I think we need more of a check and balance system. And if we're going to be investing that kind of money, making loans and whatnot, which in the end the city is responsible for, we should be looking, you know, looking downwind. What are we doing? Are we creating a winner, somebody who gets the contract, or are we creating conditions that will allow all of our businesses to thrive? And I really feel that general infrastructure was very much neglected in all this. And then we have some, you know, some shell game tricks of the trade. our last budget was balanced selling the Kaiser Convention Center to ourselves as the Redevelopment Committee. And I've been asking for about 9 months, who owns it now? Who owns it now, and where did the debts go? And, you know, there are some serious questions on the budget. I don't say that to be accusatory, but we need a stable budget. We need to, our last budget, we threatened to close 14 out of 18 libraries. The budget before that, we actually let go 80 police officers at an untold five-year expense just to get back to where we were. That's not stable government. And so I really would like to see, I'm very conservative, I guess, in that way. I would like to see our expenditures understood. I would like to make sure that we have provided for the fluctuations in the business cycle, that we know what we do when taxes are up, and we know what we do when revenues are down, and try to provide stability for those core services.
Just a quick digression. Have you found any good resources that account for the way the city spent redevelopment money? This isn't like an interview question. I'm actually just...
Have you spoken to David Mix?
Oh, yeah, a little bit. He'd be a good person to ask about that.
He has some very good resources.
Okay.
As a Green Party candidate, I have a lot of Green Party people I can talk to. Sometimes on background.
Okay.
I've never found David Mix's numbers to be wrong.
He's good.
Yeah, his numbers are wrong, and he would tell you about how much was actually in redevelopment versus what was in the general fund.
Interesting. Stuff like that. That's so there's $1 billion in just... Oh, sorry. Yeah, right. So $1 billion. Okay.
It's not straight money.
Yeah.
Right?
Wow. Yeah.
But it was a certain amount. It was a serious amount of money.
Yeah.
And then when the county wasn't able to fulfill its obligations to the schools, mm-hmm. they had what was called the backfill funding mm-hmm. coming from the state.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this is part of how the state is now, by killing redevelopment,
right.
that money goes back to the county. The county pays its bills, and then the state takes that money back. So mm-hmm. eventually the money ends up back at the state.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's so awful about that? I mean, some of that is...
Yeah.
No, I mean, that's our junior college system. That's the Cal State University yeah. system. You
yeah.
know, it's not like we want our state to go broke.
Right, yeah.
Or we would be any better yeah. off if it did.
I mean, yeah, what redevelopment has the Uptown, Rotunda, it's got the Fox, it's got a lot of, you know, like, I tried to figure out what happened in West Oakland. There's, like, a streetscape or something, and they draw those, like, weird, jaggedy little poles at the BART station. Like, definitely doesn't seem like there's a big home run.
Yeah, and I think some of it would be, like, you know, there are gaps in the transit system. So why aren't we working together with AC Transit and BART and putting heat on them as a city of Oakland?
Mm-hmm.
And this would be something I'd very much make my, you know, one of my priorities if elected would be to put heat on these other agencies. AC Transit and BART should be working hand in glove on a regional plan. They shouldn't be trying to push projects against each other. They should be running the special buses. They should be running the links between their systems and the missing components to our system. You know, I could easily see us adding some kind of a link that went from the West Oakland BART through Emeryville and all that, all those buildups over there, and linked up to the 40th Street MacArthur BART. You know, these are the kinds of things that a city council shouldn't run, but it should certainly advocate. It should be in there saying, we want better services for our city. Yeah. That's just the same way you go to your member of council to say, I want better services from East Bay MUD. The council as a whole should go to East Bay MUD and say, we want to see you treating our businesses better in the way you do your permitting process. And that's the kind of advocacy that I think interagency advocacy that I think is really needed. It's the kind of thing I agree with Amy Lemley, except she will go in there receiving campaign funding from the same people who fund the people who sit on the BART board and the other things, where I will go in there receiving only votes from District 1. So there's times you have to go along, get along, but there's also times that you have to have the independence to represent your district, yeah. right?
But you mentioned this, you know, several candidates receiving endorsements, funding. Is that sort of...
Four of the candidates built their campaigns on what I would call a classic paradigm. I'm not saying that this is immoral or whatever, but it, I think it ties their hands. That's why I won't do it myself. And, you know, each one of them has a faction of the influential people who back them. They have endorsements from different organizations, and they do a lot of fundraising. And then their campaign itself is more of a marketing operation. There's not a movement. There is no Don Linkism when this is over, right? There is no, you know, each and every one of these is about that individual. And I've really chosen to go in a different direction. I'm trying to help build a movement. I'm trying to make sure that more and more people get active in the process, that my campaign leads to more potential candidates, more people from the grassroots able to step up and participate in local government. I think local government should be easy to get involved in and accessible.
Can you talk about your political history in the past, other offices you've run for?
Well, I ran for mayor 2 years ago, and that was unlike this campaign where I actually feel like I have a chance to win, and I'm running to win. That campaign, we were trying to raise issues. The mayor's debate ended up being a quite a number of public forums, 38 in total, all of which I attended, and all of which I spoke about community policing, restorative justice, and raised the issues. And I'm kind of proud of myself for that. And I'm also happy that the alternative people in the green, left, progressive side of things here have stepped up to the plate. We take a lot of lead from what's going on in Richmond with the Green Mayor, the Richmond Progressive Alliance. But we also have our own Oakland issues. I mean, we really need to focus on a competence in government issue as well. So that was good. And then before that, well, it goes back to when I was 19 years old and I was a trade union organizer organizing plastic workers in West Montreal, where I'm from. I grew up, spent my formative years in Montreal. I was very involved in alternative politics. I was involved in, I worked in Nicaragua. I worked in Nicaragua for 10 years where I was involved in alternative energy and things like that. I was a Nicaraguan government employee. So I actually have several years of government experience there. And then, you know, I've been here. I've done everything from school volunteer, which I do now, to, you know, I was very involved in the nonprofit movement. I was very involved with David Brower's Earth Island Institute. I worked with David Brower for a few years. You know, I'm just one of those old kind of, you know, hardcore environmentalist, leftist kind of people that's been kicking around. I'm 54. Oh, somewhere in there, I also spent 19 years in the Machinist Union. So I'm very much an industrial worker and very pro-union. Not always pro what the union management does, but, you know, I'm very pro-union. I really feel strongly about people being represented. And, you know, I feel very much part of labor. When I talk about labor with the city, workers and whatnot, I don't think of it as us and them. I am part of labor. That's my movement.
So when you assess Oakland along its environmental actions, along its labor actions, other progressive actions, liberal actions, do you feel like Oakland is doing what a progressive city should do?
I would say that Oakland has a lot of good starts. Often we fail in the follow-through, but I think we have a lot of good starts, and I think we have a lot of good public consensus for certain things. If you say, I advocate that we modify the building codes to allow for gray water use and other things like that that would make a big difference to our environment, you don't have much resistance from the public at all there for that. Also, when we talk about these things on restorative justice and whatnot, that has become the consensus opinion. And the rub is, how do you actually make it happen? And this is where Oakland just falls down miserably. In practice, what we get is the Oscar Grant, the Occupy type of disaster. Should have never happened. Or we get a lot of things that say, oh, yeah, we were going to build a transit village at MacArthur. I think they were 19 years in the planning. They are 9 years in the planning of the bicycle path that goes in front of my house on 40th Street. And that's the kind of stuff that has a lot of us frustrated. And it is definitely the kind of stuff that got me feeling that I should actually get personally involved. It's almost like the radical in me is very happy. You know, the leftist progressive is very happy with a lot of what I hear. But the manager in me is really unhappy with a lot of what I see. It's a lot of undelivered promise in Oakland.
I hear that.
A lot of people do. Yeah.
So I guess one big area, there's a couple big areas. I mean, so I can try to ask a question. How many cops should Oakland have?
How many cops or how many employees of the police department? I think I don't know. Every candidate tries to say I'm the only one that says this or that. As far as I know, I'm the only one that doesn't measure this only in armed officers with a gun. When you run something like a police department, you have to look at the whole thing. And, you know, I've been personally involved. You know, when my work in Nicaragua, I was personally involved in this kind of stuff at one point. So, you know, we have to think about what do we actually need? And like I said, where is the leaks? How much are we spending in overtime? You know, what is the real cost per police officer, total cost? You know, our last city administrator said it was $4 to $5 per $1 million. That's a lot of money, right? For a badge carrying officer.
$5 million?
No, 4 to 5 officers per $1 million.
Yeah, exactly. So about 200,000.
Yeah. Well, when you finish paying, you know, for the car and everything, it's a lot of money. And then what are the actual number of people deployed on the street? How many of them are on workers' comp, right? You know, how many of them are in leave, right? What are we paying in lawsuits? What are we paying in overtime? So I don't go that that's with some simple answer like that. I really believe that a lot of civilians need to be hired over there. Before we start hiring badge-carrying officers, I think we need to fix a lot of the problems with badge-carrying officers. But we have some emergency needs we are never going to get officers through the police academy fast enough to deal with. So we want to have problem-solving officers. They could be civilians. We want to have people who do the investigations, the lab work, stuff like that. They can be civilians. Actually, you know, people who go door to door and investigate after a murder could be a civilian. You can have civilian investigators. We certainly should only have civilians dealing with truancy. We should have civilians in there doing this triage I'm talking about as to whether or not we're actually going to prosecute somebody. Right now, it's nobody's job. And I think that we should look at the men or woman carrying a badge and a gun as not a commodity to waste. That's not a person who we need to have going to do paperwork. We can hire somebody to do the paperwork. And we should really think about redeploying them in such a way that we have more beat officers, that we have better relationship with them, that they can be the hammer when the hammer needs to be dropped. And frankly, they should be free to concentrate their resources. I don't think we should divide the police like you do fire hydrants. On the flip side, you know, the police needs some fixing. I could see us having more officers. I'd like to see some way that we fix these problems and we start hiring officers from our own community.
Yeah, I feel that. I mean, that email I sent you, the experience of watching a guy spend an hour taking a report.
Yeah. At $100 an hour, right? And, you know, when a person, a police officer, is going to someone's home to talk to the family of a high school student who isn't attending school or something like that, you got the wrong person. You've got the wrong relationship, right? And that is not the type of services they need. And also we have a lot of family disputes, a lot of domestic stuff. We have, you know, personally, I went through the court system here for divorce court. There's a lot of very questionable rulings being handed down, and they're handed to our police officers to execute, and they're often treated, they have to become the judge of a situation that they don't have the skills or whatnot to deal with. And, you know, these are the kinds of triage where I'd like to see trained civilians. We need social workers in our police force, frankly.
Where'd this you get this idea? Because I've been interested in it. I haven't seen a lot of people advocating it. Did you read it, or did you kind of come up with that on your own?
Neither. I've experienced it. I've lived in a lot of different places. I've lived in China. I've lived in Nicaragua. Grew up in Eastern Canada. Lived and worked in Italy and in Germany. And I have never seen a police force as devoid of civilians as American police forces. And so, you know, that there was somebody who wore a police uniform but not a gun who would come and talk to you about issues like your kid doesn't go to school is actually kind of common. And it really doesn't matter how we divide it up. I just feel that right now this work needs to be done. Now, maybe I'm breaking ground to want to do this way in the United States. I don't think so. I think there's some very practical stuff that could be done. As far as having civilians doing the fingerprinting and stuff like that, Mayor Jean Kwan was for that when she ran for mayor 2 years ago. I don't know what happened now, but this is not a new idea. It's not original. None of these ideas are original to me.
Yeah, just the POA puts a big stiff arm in that. You know, I've talked to Barry Donilon. I don't know if you've ever talked to him. He's a nice guy. You know, he says, you know, I mean, there's a bunch of things. He says, you know, we have a civilian police force. They're called the FBI. How many crimes do they solve? Or he says, you know, we experimented with non-armed investigators, and they got too afraid to leave their homes in the hills. You know, I mean, he's got all these reasons, but it's tempting to think that there's a deeper reason, and that reason is...
Yeah, I mean, you know, if he's anything like a good union boss, right, he should be protecting the jobs for his members. That is not the problem right now. Even if we hired like mad, it will be 5 years to bring the police force up to where it was before the layoff. And there's no danger of his membership like being unneeded or being replaced. Frankly, we're choosing now between either a civilian does the job or nobody does the job. And right now we're going for nobody. And also, as a union, frankly, you know, I'm a union guy. Who said these people were non-union employees, right? I mean, you know, maybe the civilians are in one union and the officers are in another. I'm not sure. But, you know, any good union organizer should definitely make sure that all the people are represented. His fears that these things might not work... it's kind of one of those things where I say, well, you know, if you're just dropping it at the first sign of trouble, then of course it won't work. Everything I propose is going to have a lot of difficulty getting done. Everything they propose is going to have a lot of difficulty getting done. And I think we need to have enough popular consensus on what we're going to do and then start having those problems. When we start to have those problems, when we start to say, okay, we're going to triage these youth, some of them are going to go out and reoffend immediately. We are going to learn some hard lessons, right? There is risk involved in every one of these proposals. But, you know, do we just shy away from the risk? And do we have a situation right now that is so much better? We don't. What we have is no police officer, nobody dealing with it, and they are going out and reoffending. And we have 400 people shot a year. So, you know, is it an emergency or is it not? I would treat it like an emergency.
We don't have time to go into this, but that's interesting to talk about, you know, number of people shot as a measure because, you know, reflects, you know, life-saving technologies, how good the doctor is. Shot is maybe a better metric. Do you know how Oakland stands with people shot compared to other cities?
No, I don't. That would be a sad statistic to see. But, like I said, in Nicaragua, I had duties as a militia member. And, you know, there's a big difference between shooting with intent to kill and successfully shooting with intent to kill. Now, I'm not advocating that we get any better at it. But, you know, every time one of our young people, and it's usually a black, young black man, fires one of those guns trying to kill somebody else, we have a double tragedy. The target and the shooter are both families in crisis. They are both people we need to stop and get attention to. And, you know, a person that's doing a thing like that needs to be stopped. They have gone overboard. So figure 400 times a year, somebody is deciding to do that. I think that number is more important than saying how many of the people actually live, right? Another number that's very, very important is how many of the families cooperate with the police. It's about half. That is horrible. Half. I mean, you would think that in a situation where your own child has been shot, that live or die, right, that you would be at least converted to helping the police. That shows how bad the relations are as a whole. And to me, that's a crisis. That's an emergency in and of itself.
Where did you see that number?
From the police. Captain Toribio gave me that number.
Do you have a cell? I've been trying to reach you.
No, I don't. He used to be my regional commander in North Oakland.
Okay.
So I would go to the meetings. I've been in the NCPCs, like Don Link, okay, for some time.
We should talk about that, too.
Yeah. Wait, I have to ask. You're a militia in Nicaragua?
Yes. I lived in Nicaragua at a very unusual time. And there was a war going on. Where a group of people who were more or less coalesced around the former dictator of Nicaragua were practicing like a low-level, fairly inefficient guerrilla war. And the Nicaraguan government just turned around and handed rifles to everybody standing there. And I was an electric company employee, and me and everybody else got put into the militia. I mean, I was willing to do it. And I was not forced to do it, right? And ended up doing that for about 3 years.
Did you see action?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm a combat vet. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, I really preferred talking about American imperialism at coffee shops in Montreal while having a croque monsieur. But, you know, that was what happened. And, you know, it was just a very upsetting situation. And I guess if I get anything out of it, it's really demystified a lot of things for me. To me, being a police officer is, you know, I've done that as a militia member. I've had to be there and be one of the people that arrested somebody. It's not that big a deal. Some of this stuff's not that big a deal. Just like I ran a small electric company. It was in Nicaragua. And, you know, I've seen government management. Sometimes I'm really shocked that country, as poor as it was, with the poverty caused by their general economic situation, the poverty caused by the war, they were able to do things sometimes better than us here now. And as somebody who worked, you know, training young people, as my main job was to train young people to be technicians and to work on the electrical infrastructure, sometimes I felt that I could do more for the people in Nicaragua as a government employee there than I feel that government employees can do for the people of the United States here.
Example of that?
Adult education. Nicaragua had a commitment to adult education. We were a poor country. And my employees could receive after-hours classes to bring their educational level up, so that their math and their writing skills would match what the electric company needed them to do. Why don't we have programs like that here? And we have so many resources here. And sometimes I find it very shocking.
I guess one fairly big thing we didn't talk about yet is the city's structural debt.
Yeah, we had a meeting with the Tribune. And all the guy wanted to talk about was the pension obligations, which is serious. The pension obligations are probably our biggest snowballing debt. There's no doubt about it. They are not something that comes due. He kind of makes it sound like we owe it. We do owe it, and it's several billion dollars. It's 2.5, 2.7, depending on your numbers and depending on your calcs. But we don't owe it all at once. We owe it in payments on a schedule as people retire and stuff like that. I've had trouble trying to explain that to people. Hmm. And of anybody, he should know that. What's his name? Byrne? He's the guy at the Contra Costa Times or the Bay Area News Group.
Bornstein,
yes. But, you know, I mean, you get used to this, right? But yeah, I would say he has a point. That is probably our biggest debt. But we have other debts. A lot. If you look at where the Oakland spending its money on bond debts and servicing, stuff like that, you know, before we start, we kind of sweep a lot of it off the table when we say, oh, well, we have all this money and we do this spending. And now we're going to just talk about the little slice that we have any discretion over. Well, the part that we don't have any discretion over, we do have discretion over. And we also need to schedule that. We need to have a real asset and liabilities balance sheet for the city and figure out what we're paying when and on what schedule. And I think it's absolutely ironic that it's a Green Party guy that's standing there saying, hey, you just don't have your capitalist books in order. But they don't. They really don't. And, you know, too much money gets scuttled off here and there. And we really need books that look at our complete liabilities and how we're going to schedule them.
Do you feel like the other candidates are addressing the problem in a realistic way?
No. And because they are, the pension debts are the biggest piece. And they talk about the pension debts in different ways, and they talk about their support for the unions or support for whatever we've done. Okay, as a union member, I was on a machinist pension, and we paid into that plan. All the money crossed the table on payday. Now, they want to have a fixed benefits plan, stuff like that. Most America doesn't have a fixed benefit plan. Why we're not even just participating in Social Security like a normal citizen, I don't know, right? I know the history of it, and, you know, it's supposed to be so much better and all that. Well, since 2008, I think so much better it isn't, right? And the idea that all of our holdings are going to be in investments, right, which almost always, yeah, and it's almost always means stock. And, you know, there's a lot more to a diversified investment portfolio than that. So I have some real skepticism there. But more than anything else, I think we have to switch over to some other way of paying our employees, all of our employees, not just the new ones.
Sorry, could you say it again, that bell?
Yeah. We have to have some other way of paying our employees so that we pay our debts in full on payday. We have to stop growing this debt. We have to move everybody into a program that's fair and is fully vested on payday. Whatever the city owes, it should cross the table on payday and go into their pension plan. We should not leave the city owing the employees a pension. Once they've worked a day, that pension day should be paid.
Is that how CalPERS works now?
No.
Something
oh yeah, oh yeah, but it's not a payment in full. We have payment obligations, right? We are going to need to pay out. And frankly, CalPERS at times baffles me, right? Because it's not really a fixed payment, and it is something of a fixed benefit. Although how that benefit is calculated is pretty wild. And some people can, like, opt to amp up how much they're going to. We would go into bankruptcy or some version thereof, and the same thing will happen to their pensions that happened to the auto workers, stuff like that.
Do you think bankruptcy is a possibility for the city?
Yes. One to be avoided. I really believe in avoiding it. With the last couple of cities that have gone into bankruptcy, this might become a snowball effect, and we might not have any choice. It might be that, you know, the state might even step in and say, okay, we're going to do an adjustment of all the cities. In a certain way, they just did. They just changed the rules with pensions. And, you know, and they might be deservedly so needing to do that. Yeah.
Sorry,
supposed to be capitalist? But, you know, that, you know, we have to stop making decisions on short-term trends. Yeah. Right? I mean, I'm not a, you know, great capitalist economist, but you need to diversify your portfolio and not make decisions based on short-term trends. That's just, you know, and all the decisions that were made, I don't know, they thought real estate was going to go up forever and that we were going to sell it at an ever faster rate. Yeah. That just never happens, right? And not with Prop 13. Prop 13 is such a penalizer for anybody to buy in. And that's across California. So, you know, people buy real estate and then they have to be able to do something more upscale for it to afford the new price of money and the new price of taxes. And right. So there's only, you know, we can't convert everybody to upscale. That's not happening. Yeah. Right. So working class people still need to be able to buy homes and be able to rent homes. And people who own buildings need to be able to rent the units out and actually be able to afford to. And they are competing now against people who have this Prop 13 giveaway, who rent portfolios of real estate and pay very little in taxes indeed. Yeah. So that until you actually deal with that, you're not dealing with the actual realities of the cash flow of most of the businesses in the real estate sector.
Yeah.
And that's in all of California, not just Oakland. Yeah. A lot of Oakland's problems are not particular to Oakland. Richmond has similar problems, you know, Long Beach has similar problems, right? And in many ways, we're not so much a city anymore as we're just part of a metropolitan city. Oakland is part of the Bay Area.